really a pleasure to have Dr. Shapiro with us. His classes are fascinating and really has a lot to add to our understanding of the sociology and development of orthodoxy. And with that introduction, I'm sure most of you know he's a graduate of Harvard University. He's written two extremely well-received, you know, books. And he's always working articles, and he's got, I think, another book coming out soon on Rambam. And without further ado, it's a pleasure from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to welcome Dr. on board. And Mark, we'll let you take it away. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Again, thank you for having me. This, again, we're going 8 sessions. We go about 55 minutes, and then we have questions. Occasionally, if you want to send something in the middle, but it's probably better usually to wait to the end. I'll stop also in the middle for questions. First, I want to thank the Emersons for making this possible, and I hope that it'll be as informative for me as well as for you as the last sessions have been. Now, we began last year what I called Architects of Modern Orthodoxy, and then we moved into what we called Movers and Shakers of Postwar Orthodoxy. And now we're moving back to, again, Architects of Modern Orthodoxy. And to repeat what I said at the very first lecture, that doesn't mean that any of the people we're going to be discussing would be regarded as, quote, modern Orthodox if they lived in the year 2007. What it does mean, however, is that they not all believe the same thing, but they each had ideas which become part and significant parts of later modern orthodoxy, new ideas, new conceptions about how traditional Judaism has to develop, a new approach. And the figures we will be looking at are really, as you'll see, part of a new world. They believe in responding to the challenges, not just living as Jews had up until then, responding to the challenges with new approaches, often integrating traditional Judaism with the new world. All of them were in agreement that in the modern world, Jews cannot simply live in the ghetto, and that there has to be new ways, new approaches for dealing with the modern world. Now, the first figure we're going to deal with, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, I think he can be regarded as the first modern Orthodox rabbi, that is modern with a small m, not modern Orthodox the way we use it, but first Orthodox rabbi, maybe you can even say he's the first Orthodox rabbi, getting back to what we said in the very first class, that Orthodoxy is really about living in a time where traditional Judaism is no longer the way things are done, and you have to make a conscious choice. Maybe the Chasam Sofer was the first, but he's certainly in Germany the first of the modern Orthodox rabbis. And he's very different, as we'll see, from the rabbis who came before him, and he will become the standard model of the German Orthodox rabbi, a model that really remained the dominant model in Germany until World War II. Let me give you first some of his biography before we get into his ideas, which are really the most important things. He was born in 1798 in Karlsruhe in Germany, and he died in 1871. He studied under his father, who was the rabbi there, who was a rabbi, but not the rabbi of the city. He also studied under the rabbi of Karlsruhe, a man by the name of Asher Wallerstein, who, although himself is not of any great significance, his father, Rabbi Aryeh Leib, was the great Shagas Aryeh, one of the most important 18th century rabbi, so a very important family. Wallerstein had a yeshiva in town, and that was the model of yeshivas. Until the Volozhin yeshiva in the early 19th century, the way it worked was that a rabbi would be hired, he would negotiate with the townspeople how many students he could be brought in, and they would house the students at people's houses and supply feed them. People, they didn't have dormitories, and they didn't have dining rooms. People ate at different houses every night. And that was what a yeshiva was. And when the rabbi left, the next rabbi would come, and maybe he would open yeshiva, maybe he wouldn't. But these were ad hoc institutions set up by rabbis, and as I said, the amount of students in them depended on how generous the community was. The Volozhin yeshiva, which begins early 19th century and then becomes the dominant model, believed that the yeshiva, the sort of Chaim of Volozhin's idea, has to be independent of the community. It has to be a national institution, not dependent on the community. Money is raised from all over, and students will come from all over. But Ettlinger went to a yeshiva, the yeshiva run by the local rabbi, and that was the model up to that period. The problem was, what Rav Chaim of Volozhin wanted to prevent was the yeshiva just becoming tied to any local community. I think in theory he also would have liked to prevent what did happen, namely that the yeshiva became another Yerusha, that it was given to children and grandchildren and stayed in the family, because that defeats the purpose of the yeshiva trying to get the best and the brightest as their Rosh Yeshiva. Although I will say that when it came to Volozhin, the top level of the students kept it as a top institution, even though it was in the family. I mean, you had great people like the Netziv and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, but when the Netziv tried to give it to his son, tried to have Rav Chaim Berlin take over the yeshiva, the students actually rebelled, and Rav Chaim Berlin was never accepted. So the students were very cognizant of their role also as making sure that the yeshiva remained on top. And if you look at yeshivas today, and we have some in America, I think of Cleveland, that's a very good example, which have very much declined, you see what happens when yeshivas really are no longer looking for the best and the brightest, but it becomes a private fiefdom. So getting back to Ettlinger, he studied in Karlsruhe for a little while, and then he went to Würzburg in Germany to study with Rav Avraham Bing, who was Rav of Würzburg and had a yeshiva there. Now, I dare say today that the name Avraham Bing is not one even listening here has ever heard of Avraham Bing. But in his day, he was one of the leading German rabbis. All we have in terms of writings from him is a very small volume of Chidushim, of his Navelet on the Shulchan Aruch. But that's true. I mean, you have many great Talmidei Chachamim who didn't publish Sfarim. Sometimes they're students, they had devoted students, and they put out the stuff in their names. But we have many great Talmidei Chachamim who are totally forgotten today, precisely because they never published anything. But in their time, they were quite influential. Let me just give you a few of his great students to show you how influential. Nathan Adler, who becomes Chief Rabbi of England, really the first of the great Chief Rabbis of England, a modern commentary on Unculus, Matino Laguerre. His son, Herman Adler, then he really established the Chief Rabbinate. He incidentally had Hirsch won and become Chief Rabbi of England. The development of German Orthodoxy would have been completely different, obviously. And English Orthodoxy maybe would have become the center of Western Orthodoxy. Zelmendaer Bamberger, who later becomes Rav of Würzburg, he was the great opponent, if you recall, of Hirsch, and the question of, do you need to separate from communities that also have Reform segments to it? We already discussed him in our lectures dealing with Samson Raphael Hirsch. Also, a man by the name of Abraham Rice, I don't know if any of you know him, he is probably the first Orthodox rabbi in Orthodox rabbis in America during the pre-Civil War period. One was Bernard Illowy, who came from Hungary. He was sort of the Chassam Sofer, and the other was Abraham Rice. There was another one named Maurice Rafal, but he really wasn't a great Talmud Chacham. He was more of a preacher type. He's, I'd perhaps say, infamous, because during the Civil War, he was in the South, and when Isaac Meir Wise gave a famous speech, which was published, about how Judaism has to adopt the position of the North in opposition to slavery, Maurice Rafal proved in his pamphlet that Judaism accepts slavery, and I don't need to tell you that he then became a hero in the South in his pamphlet justifying slavery, saying you have to be nice slave, you have to treat them well, but the idea that an Orthodox rabbi was the leading Jewish spokesman in favor of the Confederacy, leading religious Jewish spokesman, of course, Judah Benjamin, as the first Jewish Secretary of State before Kissinger, was the premier Jewish spokesman. Maurice Rafal, as an Orthodox spokesman for the cause of the Confederacy, is, I think, not something that we should be proud of. But in any event, Abraham Rice was another student of Bing, and he became perhaps the leading Orthodox rabbi in America during the Civil War era. He died in Baltimore in 1862, and you could read all about him in Harold Sharfman's massive book called The First Rabbi. You can also read Rice's polemics against the various Reform leaders in the United States in The Occident, which was Isaac Leeser's periodical. It now is available online. Just plug in The Occident and you can read, I don't know, 20 years worth, plenty of articles from Abraham Rice and other Orthodox spokesmen. When Orthodoxy was obviously very small in the United States and German Reform was dominating, you can read. For those who don't know, let me just mention Sharfman, the late Rabbi Sharfman, the Wayu Musmach from Revel. He also started the half see a lot of places, especially if you go to Whole Foods, Newman's tomato sauce and others. And as far as I know today, it's accepted by everyone. That wasn't always the case. I know the CRC and others. So it's considered one of the most reliable hashgachas as far as I know today. Now, getting back to Ettlinger, while he was in Würzburg studying, as mentioned, he also did what a number of the other students did in Würzburg. He went to study secular studies at the university. First, before he went to the university, there was a Jewish school in town that offered these courses in order to enable the Jews to get it to a certain level where they could then go on to university studies. And he went on to the University of Würzburg. He never graduated there, but he went on there, and he had to leave because in 1819, there were the anti-Semitic riots known as the Hep-Hep riots. You see, in terms of the sound is a problem. I don't know if it's on our end, but we'll try to fix it. Sometimes if it's too loud for you, you can lower it. That forced Ettlinger out of the university. Anti-Semitic riots took place all over Germany. By the way, we don't know why they were called Hep-Hep. If you look in the Encyclopedia Judaica, it appears this was the cry that Germans used for domestic animals. It wasn't a pogrom in the sense of Kristallnacht. There were no deaths, but there was a lot of broken windows, and Jews were afraid. And many Jews left the universities where they were not welcome. So although Ettlinger never finished the university, and he wasn't the rabbi doctor, which became the model of German Orthodoxy in the next generation, we see that he had a positive view of studies, and he studied philosophy at the university. He was perhaps the first modern rabbi, first traditional rabbi to go to the university. Again, I'm sorry about the sound going on and off. We haven't had this in the past. I don't know if that's for everyone. The technical services is certainly it. The first PhD in Germany was actually Nathan Adler at Würzburg, but the first one to go to the university as far as I know. That he was such a love. And he used to it's hard to believe that Germans know enough Latin around using Latin terms, but that's also mentioned. The fact that he was such an outstanding Rav and attended the university at a time when it was not fashionable created many problems in the eyes of what today we would call the extremists or the traditionalists. In Judith Bleich, J. David Bleich's wife, she's also a great scholar in her own on Jacob Ettlinger, for some reason was never published. I have a PDF of it if anyone's interested. She quotes in her dissertation on Ettlinger Kaufmann Kohler's reminiscences. Kaufmann Kohler was a leading reform rabbi in America, but he had earlier come from. And he recalls that when he was growing up, people said, and this was the legend of the time, that Satan, no less than Satan, the Satan, led Ettlinger to the university. Why? And by the way, the Satan also ensured, the Yetzer Hara, the Satan, however you want to call it, ensured that Ettlinger would go to the university and that he would come out unscathed so that other rabbis and young people would see, hey, that this great rabbi went to the university and came out unscathed, and they would then do the same. And of course, as we know, many of them did not come out unscathed. So that was the legend that Ettlinger, it was actually the Satan that convinced him to go to the university in order to poison German traditional Judaism so that they came to this ideology, which they did come to, that every Jew, every rabbi needs to go to the university. In fact, there are descendants of Ettlinger today in the land of Israel who are Haredi, very traditional. If you know the Devar Yerushalayim Yeshiva, Rabbi Horowitz, they're direct descendants of Yaakov Ettlinger, and they published a new edition of the Binyan Sion, which are the responses Bettlinger, which I'll mention two volumes. Here we see the cover. You see how thick it is. Very nice volume. And when it was published, the editor, his name is Yehuda Horowitz, he included this at the very end. It looks like this. After the book is completed, you have a copy of a text from Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, on the one hand, and Zionism on the other hand. Question is, what reason did that university? He never really reminisced about it. You can see for how he guided his students. He thought that in the modern world, Jews are not going to be living in the ghetto, and therefore you need an education. Germany was opening up, and that becomes the motto, as we've seen with Hirsch, and we'll see with Hildesheimer and Hoffman. The role of Jews is not to be in the ghetto, but to be in the outside world. And obviously, if you don't want to be a merchant, you need to have some sort of education. Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, getting back to him, he, as I said, combined this fanatical anti-Zionism with fanatical Zionism with fanatical traditionalism, so much so, by the way, when he was in the land of Israel, he attacked the old yeshuv. He said they should be, instead of getting the chalukah money, the charity which was sent from the diaspora, they should be out there building up settlements and working the land. Needless to say, he got put in chayrim for this, but... he spoke about Ettlinger, and he writes in one of his books first of all he says that the reason Ettlinger went to the university is because the law required him to, which is of course false. And then he laments how contemporaries, that is his contemporaries, the late 19th century, were using Ettlinger as a model, as a support, to show that he could go to the university. So this was put in the back by the Haredi great-grandchildren of Yaakov Ettlinger, so that everyone who studied he's the Binyan Tzion and sees what a great postake he is, won't assume that the secular studies is a good thing and they can follow him as well. Remember, Yaakov Ettlinger is too big to ignore or to regard him as misguided. He's a universally recognized gadol, great sage, including in the most right-wing yeshivas. And yet, he seems to give a hechsher to secular studies. And how did that work with the Haredi opposition to secular studies? He later became a chassid in River. Suffice it to say that he's far from the hashkafot to have. He's Mershi in Lux today. And he was very apologetic when I asked him about this, telling me that he was very young, maybe just even 20 years old there. And I think, by the way, it shows that he's a bit of an eloid. Because it's full of learning notes, and he said that someone told him you should put this in, so he put it in. And he regrets it today. In later years, Ettlinger became the Rav of the city of Altona. In Germany. And there was a Jewish boys and girls school under his control, and of course they taught secular studies. In 1825, he was appointed to a rabbinic position in Mannheim, and 2 years later, the district rabbi of Mannheim, he had a yeshiva which had over 50 students in it. One of his students was Hirsch. So we see Ettlinger is the Rebbe of Samson Raphael Hirsch. He had a great reputation as a Talmudist, as the that have become basic to the Jewish library. This is a very and very culinary stuff. Not today. I don't know if it's focused on it. And it's a work. I'm sorry on this. It's always a perfect connection. In 1830, he comes Rav. I mentioned before they established a school. That was after he ran the school. This actually used to be known as the Triple Community of Ahu. Aleph Hei Vav. It stands for, and the most famous rabbi of Altona was Rabbi Yonatan Eiffe years before. Now, when he comes to Altona in 1836, Hamburg is no longer under its jurisdiction. They're separate. In Altona, Ettlinger also has the yeshiva, and this time Israel Hildesheimer becomes his student. So the two leading scholars in 19th century, from mid-19th to late 19th century Germany, Israel Hildesheimer and Samson Raphael Hirsch, are students of Yaakov Ettlinger. And we will see, we've mentioned this briefly in Hirsch's discussion, and we'll see what you do with Hildesheimer. Hirsch and Hildesheimer have very different visions of traditional Judaism. Okay, I want to stop now. I want to stop for a minute.
Okay, I apologize for the technical difficulties. I don't know exactly what we're having them, but we're working on them to fix them as fast as we can, and then we'll restart. Okay, I apologize.
obligations as Jews and citizens, which is, and there was a test they were given, a public examination about their religious, about what they had studied, what they knew religiously, and this is exactly modeled, no different, than what happens in the Protestant confirmation. Obviously, there's nothing Christian about Ettlinger's confirmation ceremony. It was in a shul. They weren't asking questions about Jesus or anything like that. Everything was Jewish. It wasn't even called confirmation, but it really was the same thing, and he believed that this is something that in the times, you need to do this in that era. And it shows how he was willing to make adjustments to traditional practice in order to make Judaism more appealing and more modern. In later years, it actually became a government requirement that you have to have these public examinations. But Ettlinger was the one who said that it should be in the shul, and he took part in it. Now, some Orthodox synagogues in our country, in America, used to have confirmations, if you can believe it. Last Shavuos, I was in Houston at United Orthodox Synagogues, and they have all the, in the hallway there, if anyone's been there, you'll know they have pictures of the various confirmation classes going back to the 50s or even the 40s, and it stopped, I think, in the late 1970s. One of the rabbis, I don't know if he'd want to be reminded, he used to be president of the Rabbinical Council of America about 5-6 years ago. You see him in the 1970s together with the confirmation class of United Orthodox Synagogues of Houston. But today, certainly there are no Orthodox synagogues that have confirmations, although it is popular in Reform, it's standard in Reform, and I think it's still popular in conservative shuls, and truth be told, it's a very good idea that when kids are older, 15 or 16, you have some sort of, kids don't mature as young as they used to. And at 13, really, how much does someone know? At 15, 16, they can really speak much more intelligently about what it means to be Jewish. But obviously, it's because of Chukas HaGoyim, because of how it'll look, I don't think Orthodox rabbis in this country can start instituting confirmations. But that's what was going on in Germany. Now, in addition to the many articles in his journal, he published some other very important works. I already mentioned the Aruch HaNer. He also published Bikurei Yaakov, which was his first published work, and it deals with the laws of Sukkos, standard work. Yet it's his responsa, the Binyan Sion, volumes 1 and 2, reprinted in this work, which now they call it the responsa of the Aruch HaNer, because they included some other stuff. That's his most important. And we're going to talk now about the Tshuvot, the responsa of the Binyan Sion, which are the most important responsa in all of 19th century Germany. To this day, as I said, remain very important, and there are many of them that are influential, and we need to discuss both into this class and the next class. And let us begin with his most famous responsum, which is quoted and requoted, pro and con, and it's found in the second volume of the Binyan Sion, number 23. And he was asked what to do about Shabbos violators in modern times, that is in the early 19th century, early to mid-19th century. And what if they touch wine? Can we drink their wine? When you ask the question, if they touch wine, is it still kosher? You're asking, are they to be regarded like non-Jews? We all know that if non-Jews touch wine that's not cooked, we can't drink it because the rabbis made a decree. They want to keep us away from mixing with non-Jews. It'll lead to intermarriage, etc. I mean, if the rabbis were around today, in those days, wine was essential. It was a central feature of drinking. But today, they probably would say you can't drink Coke. Coke if the non-Jew touches. But that's the halacha. We can't drink wine. When you add to the argument, this was to be the norm, if you're talking about confirmation, he didn't have anything against it. That's what was done in his community, and other communities did it as well. In Mordechai Eliyahu's book, he speaks about the various confirmations. He had wrote a book on Jewish education in the Haskalah period. It wasn't regarded as really a Christian thing. It was regarded as a German thing to do. Just like in Germany, as we'll see, the rabbi wearing the gown was regarded as not a Christian thing, but a German thing. And having a choir was not a Christian thing, it was a German thing. So it wasn't an issue. Any community that wanted to have a confirmation-like thing, when you think about it, what could be bad? Having the boys and girls at 15 and 16, just like the Christians do, get together in front of the community and show that they've learned and they know what it means to be a Jew. When you think of it, I mean, how can anyone find anything wrong with it? But then it becomes involved, then the Reform make it so central a feature of their religious life, and they abolish the bar mitzvah. it's, they don't have the confirmation in addition to the bar mitzvah. They abolish the bar mitzvah. Once the Reform have abolished the bar mitzvah and are only doing confirmations, it becomes almost impossible for the Orthodox to do it, except in places like Houston and other places where the Orthodox synagogues were populated by non-Orthodox Jews, and these people wanted confirmations, so the rabbis went along with it. Why? What is it, though, that if a non-religious Jew, a non-Shomer Shabbos Jew, touches the wine, it should be like a Gentile does? Well, yes, as Rabbi Cohen points out, the bar mitzvah is very low-key. As Rav Moshe Feinstein said, if he had the power, he'd abolish bar mitzvahs, because there's more bar than mitzvah. I mean, a bar mitzvah is supposed to be getting aliyah, and you have a little schnapps afterwards. You don't have giant kiddushes and all these things. Yes, there's no parties, but the boy could give a drasha. He would give a drasha, and he can give another drasha when he said it's so-called confirmation. That, remember, Atlinger didn't use the word confirmation, but it was the exact same thing. Okay, well, what if the Talmud says that if a non-Jew who's a Mechal Shavis is treated like a Gentile? That doesn't mean he's equivalent to the Gentile in everything. If a non-religious Jew still has to give his wife a get, I mean, so that, but in certain aspects, he's regarded as having the status of a non-Jew. Touching the wine was one of the issues, by the way, it was a big machokas about, because you can marry the daughter of a non-religious Jew. There's no problem with that. So many rabbis held that he doesn't create problems touching the wine. But, for example, he cannot be a witness at a wedding or on a get, or there's other areas in which we regard him as a non-Jew, because Shabbos testifies to the creation of the world, and by not, Talmud says, if you do not recognize the Shabbos, if you don't rest on the Shabbos, you're denying really the creation of the world, you're denying God's governance of the world, and you're removing yourself from the people. Think of a traditional society when everything stopped on Shabbos. Think of a place like B'nai Brak or Bayit Pagan. Everything stops, and the one person who doesn't observe Shabbos is making a conscious choice to remove himself from involvement with the community. Now, there's lots of other sins, of course, but Shabbos is a public sin. What does it mean? How could you publicly eat non-kosher? There's no McDonald's in B'nai Brak or anything like that. If you happen to go to a place where no one knows you and eat non-kosher, it's not really, it's not such a public thing, and kosher doesn't even come to the level of Shabbos. Shabbos is a biblical command. Shabbos is really very central. And that's what the rabbis of the Talmud said. And there's all questions. Can you lend him money on interest, etc.? They discuss it. Some communities even have Shomer Shabbos sections of the cemetery. Can you count a Mechal Shabbos in the minyan? These are all questions that were dealt with. And Ettlinger was asked his opinion. Now, the particular question has to do with wine, but it really reflects on every area, counting to a minyan, etc. What he says is incredible. He writes that he does not know how to evaluate the contemporary Sabbath violator. In his day, people were beginning to reject Judaism. I don't think in the cities you probably have majority non-observant in his time, but in the small towns, no. But he sees the way it's going. Within another generation or two, Orthodoxy is at 10%, 15% in Germany. So you're not, he says, his understanding is that when Chazal and the Rishonim spoke about a Mechal Shabbos, a Sabbath violator, as being an outcast, not part of the community, they're referring to a case when everyone is religious, and you have an exception, one who makes a conscious choice to be non-religious. But what do you do in a situation where the majority of people are non-religious, and people are brought up being taught that you can be Jewish and not be religious? I mean, look, if you're in Israel, you can be a very good Jew. After all, Omert is not a Shomer Shabbos, and Shimon Peres is not a Shomer Shabbos, and I mean, no, the leaders of the Jews are not Shomer Shabbos, so why would you assume that violating Shabbos is such a terrible thing? So Ettlinger writes that he doesn't know how to evaluate them. Furthermore, he points out that today, he's writing early 19th century, you even have people who come to shul in the morning and then violate Shabbos in the afternoon. And we certainly had that in the United States for a long time, not so much anymore, at least not in the big areas, but if you go out west, smaller towns, you have plenty of people who come to the Orthodox shul. They're not Shomer Shabbos. They'll drive to the shul, or they'll go home, they'll be Mechal Shabbos, even if they walk the shul. Sephardim in Israel, this is a big phenomenon. They're very traditional, but they'll watch the TV or go to the soccer games. So, since the rabbi said that the person who violates Shabbos is rejecting God, rejecting Torah, Ettlinger says, these people violate Shabbos, but yet they'll say Kiddush. They'll come to shul. So they don't reject Torah. They say Kiddush. They show that they accept God and they created the world, but they choose, for whatever reason, they don't know any better, not to observe Shabbos. So how do you judge these people? Hey, the parallel is obvious also to America when in the turn of the century. If we have a unit on Rav Chaim Hirschenson, we'll deal with him. These were from Jews who had to work on Shabbos to support their family. They didn't like to work on Shabbos. They went to shul Shabbos morning. There are even 6 o'clock mornings, minyans, Shabbos mornings, so that they could be done by 8 o'clock, 8:15, and then go off to work. These were not people who were opposed to traditional Judaism. These were people they thought it was very unfortunate, but they had to work on Shabbos. How to judge these people? He concludes that from the standpoint of halacha, only one who brazenly violates the Shabbos in front of 10 people, publicly, he says publicly, which means in front of 10 people, is to be regarded as a Shabbos violator. And when he says brazen, he means someone who doesn't care. That is, someone who completely rejects Judaism and violates the Shabbos. One who is embarrassed by what he does and upsets that he has to violate Shabbos, well, he's not to be regarded as brazen. I would say even if you work in the post office, everyone sees you working on Shabbos, if you're upset that you have to do it, you don't want to have to do it, you give your children a Jewish education, you go to shul when you can, that's not a brazen Shabbos violator. Now, this position of Ettlinger, that in today's day and age, it's very difficult to find a brazen Shabbos violator, that almost all of those who violate Shabbos are those who either violate it because they don't know any better or violate it because they feel they have to, but none of them are to be regarded as Mechalei Shabbos, this has been enormously influential. It's quoted over and over by Poskim, including by Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski. And there are all sorts of developments from this logic. For example, I heard of Pesach, I believe it's from Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who develops this Binyan Sion idea, that even if one is a Mechalel Shabbos, public violator of the Shabbos, so that he even mows his lawn on Shabbos, so everyone could see, but if the rabbi was walking down the street, if he'd be embarrassed and he'd go inside, he's not to be regarded as a public Shabbos violator. Now, this is, you say, what's the big deal if you're regarded as a public Shabbos violator? Because there are all sorts of things. First of all, you have the issues of the wine, but you have plenty of cases where someone was a witness on, let's say, not so much on a get, but at a wedding, and then we find out later that he's really a Shabbos violator. What do we do about the wedding? There's all sorts of implications. Can he testify in court? So it's important to know the parameters. So if you're embarrassed, Rashom Zalman said, even for the rabbi, then you're not a brazen Shabbos violator. It shows you still have some Jewish feeling. And also, 99% of the times, if you're not embarrassed, if the rabbi walks down the street, you find this in communities, and you give the rabbi a big hello, you even take a Shabbos to him, it shows that you're a Tinuk Shadishba. You don't know any better. Because you're not embarrassed to go inside, and you're not embarrassed to stay out there. Basically, you're just a typical Jew who doesn't know anything. So there are very few Mechalei Shabbos around today. What Ettlinger did is create a new category. I think we can best call it the God-fearing Shabbos violator. This category did not exist in pre-modern times, and it shows you that Orthodox halakha can be very dynamic. Now, his position was disputed, most famously by the Munkacher Rav. We spoke about the Munkacher when we dealt with the Satmar Rav. He deserves his own session. He says this is nonsense. Chazal told us the Shabbos violator is to be treated like a non-Jew, and we can't start reading psychology here. What does Chazal mean? They only meant it in the era when most people were Shabbos violators. No, a Shabbos violator is a Shabbos violator, and you're going to suffer terribly for this. The Munkacher Rebbe spoke about how what was happening in Germany to the Jews was because they violated Shabbos. Yes, he's not an architect, but he's certainly a mover and shaker. But the majority opinion of Poskim holds like the Binyan Sion, yet that we relate to a Shabbos violator today as one who doesn't know any better. The whole notion of Tinuk Shenishba really begins with, that is an unwitting violator, begins with the Binyan Sion. Yet if you go to the Karma Wine Factory, I have been there, you will see that they only have Shomer Shabbos Jews downstairs involved with the wine. That's because, first of all, they want to adopt the most machmir position, because there are people, look, they want to sell to the Munkacher Hasidim also. So they're careful to only have Shabbos violators, but they do have plenty of religious Zionists Vicky Potsergoat, so it's not just the Haredim working on it. And also, it has to be said that if you just hire anyone, I mean, I don't think you can make a blanket assumption. It could be that you hire someone who really is a brazen Shabbos violator, and we do have brazen Shabbos violators. Apparently, Rav Yoshev ruled that Rav Don Siegel, who's one of the leading mashkichim in Israel, his brother, who became non-religious, Yisrael Segal is Siegel, and then became a leading personality in Israel, that he is a real brazen violator, because he went to the Panavez Yeshiva and then gave it all up. Obviously the hashkachas are not going to give hashkacha if they think there's even a possibility that a brazen Shabbos violator could come in. Rav Yoshev ruled that Rav Don Siegel should not sit Shiva for his brother, because you're not supposed to sit Shiva for a brazen Shabbos violator. But today we assume that no one's brazen. But the Shulchan Aruch does speak about those who are Parshim Midarchei Tzibur, and Rav Yoshev ruled that his brother Siegel, who was a leader of the anti-religious movement in Israel, he qualifies. Yeah, the Chazon Ish held you can't have any brazen people today, although even with the Chazon Ish, it's possible that he would make certain exceptions. If someone had sat in yeshiva for 10 years, and, maybe he'd make exceptions. But yeah, the Chazon Ish also gave the same logic, but the Binyan Sion was 100 years before. I don't know if the Chazon Ish knew the Binyan Sion. He didn't really use Achroni, but Rav Chaim Moshe Grzinski quotes the Binyan Sion, as does, we'll see, Rav Doitzi Hoffman and the Stradiation, etc., etc. We should note that the whole Kirov movement really would be impossible without this sort of approach, without the Binyan Sion, without the Chazon Ish, who independently comes to the same conclusion. Who wants to be part of a religion in which the people don't know any better are regarded by us as really evil people, wicked people, Shabbos violators? So there's a dynamic response, but one which takes seriously the psychology of the Shabbos violator, and really, as I said, creates a new category. The God-fearing Shabbos violator. I coined that expression, but I think it fits very well. All I would say, though, is despite the importance of Ettlinger's tshuva, we should have no illusions, and I'm speaking here in 2007. I mean, there's all this talk today about how to stop assimilation. They're coming out with this contest. You can get 2 years scholar-in-residence at Brandeis University if you can come up with the next great Jewish idea. What's going to keep the Jewish people into the next century? The last time they did this contest, Mordechai Kaplan won with Judaism as a civilization. And Michael Steinhardt is spending all this money on trying to stop assimilation among secular Jews. And, I hate to say it, but if I speak to Michael Steinhardt, I'd say, if you're not living in Israel, at the end of the day, if you don't observe Shabbos, it's almost guaranteed that numbers of your children will intermarry. If you do observe Shabbos, there's a possibility. Look at Noah Feldman. But if you don't observe Shabbos, the odds are even your children. If you have 3 children, certain statistics say 1.5 of them are going to intermarry. So Achad Ha'am said, more than the Jews have kept the Shabbos have kept the Jews. Of course, if you try telling this to the non-religious who are in Scranton right now, they got me involved in this program to try to keep the non-religious in the fold. But from their standpoint, I can't say what the answer is, because they think the cure is worse than the disease. If you're not Shomer Shabbos, there's no way to keep the children in. It's just a reality. We're not in Vilna anymore, where everyone marries other Jews. I use the term God-fearing Shabbos violator because that's what Ettlinger describes. He describes people who are Mechal Shabbos but still say Kiddush and still come to Shul. But truthfully, he even expanded it to the people who don't say Kiddush, the people who don't know any better, their children. Yeah, I mean, his point was that no one's a heretic. The Shabbos violators who know something, they're not heretics because they don't understand the significance of the Shabbos. They think that you can still love Torah, etc., and be a Shabbos violator. And the other people, they're not heretics because they don't know any better. To be a heretic, you really need to know a lot, was what Ettlinger was saying. It's interesting that Rav Moshe Feinstein independently came to the same idea when it came to counting in a minyan, that you can count the Shabbos violators in a minyan. I'll get to that in a minute. But the standard justification is the Binyan Sion. We count them because they're Tinok Shenishva, they don't know any better. Now, the fact that I think many of you, whole conversation is striking you as strange. After all, don't we know you count any Jew for the minyan? You stand out in the street, you pull anyone in, the person hasn't been to shul in 20 years, we still count them. That only goes to show you how influential Ettlinger and his followers' approaches have been. Because when I say Ettlinger, I mean Hirsch and Hildesheimer and Hoffman and the rest of them. But I dare say if you asked someone in Poland 200 years ago in the ghetto, can you count a Michal Shabbos to a minyan, they'd say, obviously you can't. How can you count a Michal Shabbos to a minyan? Today, of course, we count everyone to a minyan. If you have to find a yarmulke and put it on their head and everything, that's what we do. Rav Moshe had a very interesting approach, though. He argued, as always, very original. The reason we know you have 10 people in a minyan, it's actually derived from the meraglim, the spies. That they're considered an Edah, a group. And Rav Moshe then brings another Talmudic statement that shows how wicked they are. The Talmud describes them as very wicked. So Rav Moshe says, if we derive the whole notion of a minyan of 10 from these wicked people, then minyan's different. It's not like wine or anything. You can count any Jew to a minyan, but that's not the standard view. The standard view is that you can't count a Michal Shabbos to a minyan, but in modern times, all the poskim say you do because these people don't know any better. Okay, we'll stop here for a minute before we move on to the next important tshuva, but let me answer a couple questions here. Does any 20th century posek not count non-observant in a minyan? Sure, you go to B'nai Brak, you go to Me'ah Shearim, they won't count a non-observant Jew in a minyan. They won't give him an aliyah. They won't, there's plenty of poskim, but not the poskim you will come across in your world. We're talking about a different type of poskim. I already mentioned the big posek from Lakewood who doesn't think that a Baal Tshuva should even sit Shiva. So, I mean, you have... You certainly have these poskim out there, but again, not in our communities. And if you're living in the ghetto in Me'ah Shearim, of course, Rav Gedalia Felder told us if someone made Kiddush and showed it, he accepted God. Okay, I think Rav Gedalia Felder was quoting the Binyan Sion. If you look in Rav Gedalia Felder's Farim, he's a big bucky in the Achronim. He quotes all the Achronim, and he quotes the Binyan Sion over and over again. So I have no doubt that this Rav Gedalia Felder was quoting the Binyan Sion and relying upon him. Yeah, okay, and it's the same thing with the wine. If you hold the Binyan Sion, the wine's not a problem. Today, however, as long as you have the Mevushel wine, we do it. But I will tell you that maybe with the turn to the right, we're seeing some moving away from the Binyan Sion, because I've seen all sorts of halachic discussions online where they do say that if you're having non-Shomer Shabbos relatives, etc., you should use Mevushel wine. And that goes against the Binyan Sion. Although maybe the Binyan Sion would say, well, if you have a choice, you know, use the Mevushel. But still. Later, ask me afterwards. I'll talk to you about the Lakewood. And Rav Moshe would give an aliyah. That's what I said. Rav Moshe derived it. We'll get to Ettlinger's position on the Reform in a few minutes. He did not consider Reform Jews brazen Shabbos violators. He considered Reform rabbis brazen Shabbos violators. And we will get to them. No, Rav Moshe would give an aliyah. He would not give an aliyah to Reform rabbis. He has a tshuva, and Rav Henkin, Yehuda Ratz Lev Henkin, disputes with that. Rav Moshe would not give an aliyah to a Reform rabbi. He's not referring to a regular Shabbos violator. Rav Moshe distinguished between an ideological heretic and just the typical person that Rav Yaakov Ettlinger was referring to. And in Yehuda Ratz Lev Henkin's tshuva, in the B'nai Vanim, he writes that you can give even a Reform rabbi an aliyah. He says you should make it like an eighth aliyah or something. And we'll get back to that at the end. When we stop at 10 o'clock, we can go into more questions, and I'll pick up. I just want to do a few more things. The context of Moses Tshuva was the typical American Jew who was Michal Shabbos, not for ideological reasons, but the Jew we know. Ettlinger was involved in other important halakhic disputes in his day. Who today even remembers the great dispute over machine matzahs, which tore European Jewry apart, with Ettlinger being one of the major forces permitting, not just permitting, thinking that the machine matzahs are a good thing, because it's better than handmade matzahs. But this was a huge dispute. Those who are interested, again, I can send you the PDF. 2 years ago, I think it was, Mayor Hildesheimer and someone else came out with a major article documenting the dispute. The two major... fighters were the Shaul Meshiv, the famous Yosef Shalom Natanson, who permitted it, and Rav Shlomo Kluger, the great Rav of Galicia, who opposed it. And they gave all sorts of arguments. Let me just tell you briefly, because it shows you how even Orthodoxy is very dynamic. One of Rav Shlomo Kluger's major reasons for opposing machine-made matzahs is that you have all these poor people who make their year's parnassa from working at the matzah factory, you know, for the month before. Nathanson's reply to this is, that's very nice that they get Parnassa, But that's not the reason why we have matzah, and that's not the only reason to tell us that we can ban machine-made matzah, because the poor people, using that logic, we could ban the train. Like the Vatican at first wanted to ban the train, because think of all the inns that were put out of business because the train didn't stop, you know, it wasn't like the horse and buggy. The train traveled all night. Or think of the typewriter companies, or all the people who made their living in Manhattan on bicycles bringing papers from law firm one to another. Now we have faxes. When the fax came in, they were all put out of business. So Nathanson said, it's very nice to provide parnassah, but how does that make it us, sir? We can't get into it now, but you have two different conceptions of what Jewish law is about. Kluger has an almost socialistic conception that we can use Jewish law to further other goals, social goals, whereas the Sholem Eishiv is saying these are fine and dandy, but that's not enough of a reason to offer something. And as I said, Ettlinger stood on Nathanson's side. If you read Hildesheimer's article, it'll be very disillusioning also, because these are two of the great Gedolim, not just two, there's Ettlinger and there's other Gedolim. If you read the way they wrote about each other, Ettlinger and Kluger each calling each other dishonest, unscrupulous, to have two of the great Gedolim referring to each other as basically dishonest people, it's disillusioning, because today we learn all this far and we think that they're great and they get nice hagiographies, and yet they clearly hated each other, or at least felt very strongly negatively about each other. They don't always say one to the other, how I think you're dishonest. They tell everyone else that this rabbi is a nobody. And so again, as I said, it's disheartening to see our Gedolim fighting with each other this way. So we'll stop here. I know now questions, if there's any questions or comments. The way we work it, for those who are new, is it seems to work out two classes for each figure, unless we go further, and I hope the sound got better.
Well, the sound much, much improved. I don't know what happened at the beginning, but anyway, thank God it improved. Also, normally during the question period, if people would like to ask questions orally, like I am talking now, just hit the transmit button, and that's probably the easiest way as opposed to writing, but you can still write if you'd like.
And certainly, if anyone doesn't want to stay, we'll go on for about 15 minutes or so with the questions if there are some. Anyone who wants the copy, if you want the copy of the Judith Leich, just email me and I'll send you the PDF.